My lesson today is Saul the Pharisee. When Solomon became king, one of the strange things that he inherited from his father, King David, was a religious system that had two high priests. Now, it's always problematic when you have two people in charge of one function. Two high priests. There's going to be trouble ahead. And the documentation of this situation is scattered in the books of Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. And a lot of my reading took place also in the Jewish sources and Jewish historian writings, etc. So not everyone was happy that Solomon became king. He had opposition. So Solomon, in order to subdue his enemies, started a program of killing people. It's an interesting way of dealing with people you don't like. It probably has survived to this day. First, he reduced his competition by having his half-brother killed. Then there was his uncle, Joab, who was general of his father's army. He had him killed. And he thought about killing the high priest of the two. There was one he didn't like, but he was a little bit fearful of killing this holy man, so to speak. So instead, he just banished him. I think he said, I should be killing you, but I'm going to banish you to a faraway corner of the country. So now they only had one high priest. And the remaining high priest was named Zadok, and that's spelled Z-A-D-O-K. He was from the tribe of Levi, and he was a descendant of Aaron. Zadok was now in charge of all things related to the temple and all religious affairs. And here's an amazing thing about this story. This family basically keeps control of the temple operation on and off for almost 1,000 years. I find that incredible. Their control would sometimes increase, sometimes decrease. Kings would come and kings would go. You know the history. But as long as there was a building there to call a temple, they were in charge of it. Same family. They ruled that religious world of the Jews for almost 1,000 years. Now you're going to recognize the family name, Zadok. Zadok was the great-great-great-great-grandfather of this family. And if you look at how the family name was spelled, you can see how this priest's name transformed into the family name. Zadok, Zadok, Sadducee. Zadok was the great-great-grandfather of the Sadducees. Now, how did this family do as far as respectfully serving Jehovah in this 1,000-year period? Well, whatever spirituality they ever originally had, they lost it quickly. It was something like the family of Aaron. We know that Aaron's sons almost immediately upon creation of the tabernacle system lost their respect for Jehovah. That's in Leviticus 10, Numbers 26. And down through all those years, the vast, vast majority of the leaders of the priesthood were far from the religious examples they should have been. You know, the nation had turmoil, and after approximately 400 years, the Babylonians invaded. They conquered Jerusalem. They ruled Israel. And after their power weakened, the Assyrians came in. And then move on down almost 800 years, and the Greeks came in and ruled them. We see these universal empires, one after the other, coming into Palestine and taking over. Now, 800 years later means that we're about 200 years before Jesus came. and the Greeks conquered Palestine, or around the year 220 BC. And this conquering by the Greeks was one of the aftermaths of the conquests of Alexander the Great. But something interesting happened when the Greeks arrived and took over the territory. The Sadoc clan, the supposed spiritual leaders of the 12 tribes, they fell in love with these heathens, the Greeks. They fell in love with all things Greek. They loved the culture that the Greeks brought in. They loved the wealth. They loved the money. They loved their big buildings. They loved their amphitheaters. They loved their great houses. They loved all the worldly activities of the Greeks, and the things of Jehovah were further and further forgotten. Interestingly enough, this family of Sadoc had become wealthy. They had money. They owned lots of property. So the lifestyle of the Greeks fit in well, because the Sadocs could well afford everything the Greeks brought in. Now you can imagine that a lot of Israelites did not like this. A lot of the Israelites did not like the Greeks. They were the invaders. As a matter of fact, we could say the majority of the Israelites didn't like it. And the gap that had already existed between this wealthy Sadducee priesthood and the common people, that gap just got larger and larger. Now, two things happened. There was a political pushback against the Greeks, and there was a religious pushback against the Sadoc family. Well, the political pushback started under the leadership of another family, the Hasmonean family, commonly given the nickname the Maccabees, and they started a slow but steady revolt. We say slow because it took them 20 years, but they finally got rid of the Greeks. Then there was also that religious pushback. And two things happened under the religious pushback. First was connected with the Maccabees, and as the Jews finally got rid of the Greeks, the Maccabee who became king, not only did he become king, but he appointed himself the high priest. And the Sadocs were out. They no longer controlled the operation. Now, it ended their control of the temple affairs. They were no longer the high priest, but they did keep all the other jobs. They kept all the other temple functions. Somebody had to do the work. And so they were there, and they kept their grip on the control of the daily activities. So they didn't just disappear. They just lost the high priesthood. Sorry. Second thing that happened, all right, we got rid of the Greeks in a time period, and we got rid of the high priest. Then the second thing that happened was a pushback against the teaching. Happens one more time, I'm going to throw the phone away, but sorry. I'm in a meeting. You're going to have to stop calling me. Wow. The second thing that happened was a pushback against the teachings of the Sadducees. You see, not only did the majority of the Jews dislike the Sadducees because of their lifestyle and their embracing the Greek culture, but the majority were tired of a lot of their teachings. Here's a quick summary of the major Sadducees' views. We only believe in what is written in the first five books of the scriptures, the five books of Moses, nothing else. We believe in a literal interpretation of everything said in those first five books, like an eye for an eye. That means literally your eye, my eye. And if it says to stone someone for an infraction of the law, we will pick up the biggest stones we can and we will kill those people. We believe the rituals of the temple ceremonies are the most important activities of our lives. We do not believe in angels. We do not believe in a resurrection of the dead. Why? Because there's no mention of that in the first five books. And from what I can deduce as I look through some of the documentation written by the Jews, they virtually did not believe in Messiah. Now, the people who fought against these teachings of the Sadducees, who did not like these doctrines and who resisted the aligning with the Greeks, they were called by the common people the Separatists. Separatists. So what did the Separatists believe? Well, they believed in more than the first five books. The first five books were called the Torah, and these people believed more than that, because what had become available is what they called the oral tradition. Now, it's kind of funny. It was called the oral tradition, but by this time, it had been all written down. So it might be more accurately called the tradition of the elders or the tradition of the fathers. So now they had the prophets. They had writings by Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel. They liked that, these Separatists. They liked the Psalms. They liked the Proverbs. They liked the story of Job. They liked the stories of Ruth and Esther. And so they called this collection of writings the Talmud. They believed in the resurrection because they saw that in these writings. They believed in the coming Messiah. They believed that an individual could pray to God. They believed that the scriptures had to be interpreted practically with a thought for everyday life. They thought the eye for the eye was not literal, but maybe an expression of equalness, meaning something of equal value, but not literally an eyeball. They thought that you could pay for your damage with something of equal value. And particularly, they did not like the obsession with the temple. They thought the relationship with God was more than that big building sitting in Jerusalem. They didn't like the temple ceremonies and the rituals. So it's pretty easy to see why they were called the Separatists. And the Hebrew word for separatist is something like Ferushi. Ferushi. And there's a couple iterations of that, and you have Pharisee. Pharisee from Ferushi. So what we've done is trace the history of the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Now, the Pharisee name was not a name that they chose for themselves. That was just given to them by the people. The people liked them. And they were not like the Aaronic priesthood, a genetic lineage. They were a highly mixed group of people. It could have been anybody, and most of them were common people. And we kind of acknowledge them for the fact that they wanted an individual personal relationship with God. And they believed in a lot of good things. And for their honest ways of life and their more reverent lifestyle, they were respected and liked very much by the people. Now, these Pharisees were off to a good start. But you know what happened and what happens time after time. Just like the followers of Zadok, over time, they too degenerated into a worldly, non-spiritual group. So it has to be said that these Pharushis, over perhaps 150 years from their good beginnings in the days of the Maccabees, this group degenerated, and by the time of Jesus, most of them had lost their spirituality. Now, what are our lessons so far? Well, I don't think we can escape the lessons of these big religious organizations. They start out just fine, but they get too big, and they eventually lose their spirituality. The adversary works his way into big groups, seems like he takes over, and he especially goes after the leadership, the high priests, so to speak. We also see in almost every case that there's a small group that pushes back. The separatists. I guess you could say there have always been separatists. Well, they're the minority. They get ostracized. They keep their spirituality. Eventually, they remove themselves from the original group. And I would say that if we're looking for a big lesson or a lesson from this big picture, I conclude that Jehovah is looking for individuals, not groups. Now, let's move this forward to the time of Jesus. Now the Romans are on the scene. They were in charge of Palestine. They had defeated the Maccabees, who had defeated the Greeks. And now the Romans ruled all of Palestine and huge portions of the then world. You know that. The Romans always wanted to be in control, but they didn't want to run the country day to day. So they created councils wherever they went. In this area of Palestine, they created a council of local native people. They had 71 members on the council. The council ruled on the big issues. Now the Romans packed it mostly with Sadducees because they had the money. They were kind of the elite. And the Romans liked that. But because the Pharisees were also very popular amongst the people, they also had, the Romans had to put Pharisees in this council also. So this council was called the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin, or the assembly, would run the day-to-day activities of the country. Now, that was government, but at the same time, there was also the function of education. In addition to the role of the civil government, the religious leaders also were responsible for educating the next generation of leaders. So how did the Sadducees feel about this? Well, they didn't care that much about anybody else because they wanted the priesthood and the leadership to be limited to their family clan. So they took care of their own education within the family groups. The thought came to my mind that maybe this is where they originated the homeschool concept. They were the homeschool people of that era. Now, the Pharisees were different. They were made up of this big mixture of people, and they invented or developed two new systems of education. One system was for everybody. And the second system was specifically for their teachers. So the first system for everybody, the Pharisees get the credit for developing the idea of the synagogue. The Pharisees created the idea of the synagogue. They wanted to create meeting places. So they built meeting halls for reading, talking, discussing the scriptures. They kept the copies of the scriptures there. And you know how they read them and openly discussed them. In contrast, the Sadducees just wanted you to go to the temple on the big holidays. And the Pharisees said, no, we go to the synagogue every Sabbath and talk about religious topics. The second part of the education system that the Pharisees developed was the personal education of their leadership. Who would be the next rabbi? Who would be the teachers? They didn't have schools, didn't have universities, so they used a personal tutoring system. We might call it mentors, private teachers. It's a little bit like taking music lessons in our day and age. You usually don't go to a classroom with 40 people to learn how to play the violin. You have an individual teacher. It's one-on-one. That was the system of the Pharisees. That's how they were teaching their new or their upcoming rabbis. So the boys were usually started at this kind of schooling at the age of 12. And that's why in Luke 2, when the 12-year-old Jesus engages the teachers at the temple, it was no big shock to the system. The teachers there were not just floored. They were used to having 12-year-old boys come. They weren't used to the level of what they received with Jesus, but the process was already in place. And it seems that this is exactly what happened to the young boy, Saul. And as we know from the New Testament, Saul was from Tarsus, which is in southeastern Turkey. But the family sent him to Jerusalem for training. His father, Saul's father, was a Pharisee. It's recorded in Acts 23. So young boy Saul received his education in Jerusalem under the tutorship of Gamaliel. Gamaliel was the most renowned Jewish teacher of that time. So it must have been obvious that Saul had tremendous potential to be accepted by such a well-known tutor beyond the borders of the country as Gamaliel. And Gamaliel was also a Pharisee, Acts 22 and 23. So what would Saul have been taught as a young boy? Well, we saw that in the history that we just reviewed in the Sadducees and the Pharisees, what he was taught and what he was not taught. So as a Pharisee, as a young Pharisee, teenage Pharisee, he was taught belief in the entire Old Testament. So he was schooled in all the books of the Old Testament, not just the first five. He would have been taught from the beginning that there was a resurrection of the dead. He would have been taught from the beginning to look for Messiah. He would have been taught that Old Testament adages like eye for an eye, they were more a principle rather than a literal way of life and death. He was taught to pray as an individual. He was taught that he was one of the people. He was not an aristocrat or part of the elite. He was taught to respect and go to the synagogue. If you wanted to find out anybody who was interested in the scriptures, you know where you'd find him? In a synagogue. He was taught that. And along with that synagogue focus, he was taught that the temple in Jerusalem was not the end all of all worship. I think Saul's teacher, Gamaliel, was a man of high character. We see this recorded in Acts, and we could say that he was really an exception to the standard Pharisee of Jesus' time. And most of the people in the Pharisees then were unscrupulous people. And Jesus said they did everything to show off for pretense. And he talks about their prayer. Jesus talks about their prayers in Matthew 6 and Matthew 23. Matthew 23 is a terrific description of who the Pharisees were in that day and age. Jesus called them actors. And of course, the Greek word for actor is hypocrite. So Matthew 26 is the consummate description of how these people behaved. Gamaliel was one of the exceptions. There were other exceptions. Nicodemus in John 3, he was a Pharisee. A Pharisee is described in Luke 7. This man had the courage to invite Jesus to dinner at his house. This Pharisee fell back to his sectarian behavior, but let's give him credit for inviting Jesus to his house. In a different story in chapter 11, Luke talks about another Pharisee who invited Jesus to dinner. It's a bold move, but he was stumbled by Jesus not washing his hands. And in Luke 13, I think this is a highlight, it's recorded that a group of Pharisees came to Jesus and warned him that Herod was out to kill him. It was a group. That means they talked about it. They discussed it. They discussed who Jesus was. And they said, let's go warn Jesus. This madman is out to kill him. So there were some good men, although a small minority, in the Pharisees. Okay, so the bottom line of this section, what do we say? Saul, I think, was pretty wonderfully taught and educated, thorough, entire scriptures, not just specializing in the first 25% of the Old Testament. He was taught by a man who had judgment, vision, was open-minded. He had probably the best Old Testament teacher that existed. And Gamaliel's classic thinking was in the book of Acts, where in the fifth chapter it says, you know the story, Gamaliel says, if this teaching or this movement is merely human, it will collapse. But if it should come from God, you cannot defeat them. And you might be actually find yourself fighting against God. That's priceless advice. It was good advice then, it's good advice now. So, where are we? Okay, so let's move specifically to the time of Jesus' ministry. And I have a question here. In Jesus' ministry, we know that Jesus would come and go out of Jerusalem. He would preach throughout all Palestine. Where is Saul of Tarsus when all this is going on? From what we can tell, what historians lead us to believe, Saul was very close in age to Jesus. We have no record that speaks to it, but one statement is that he was a young man when he held the coats in Acts 7 when they were killing Stephen. Their definition of young man would have been under 30. Now, if he was there holding their coats, did he hear what Stephen was saying? Did he hear Stephen's lecture about Jesus? Paul says even more, he grew up in Jerusalem. How could you live in Jerusalem and not know anything about Jesus of Nazareth? Everyone had heard of Jesus, and the council talked about him constantly. How could Saul have not heard about this man from Nazareth, the man who did all these amazing miracles? The blind had sight restored, the lame walked. Jesus taught like nobody before. Jesus was famous. Where was Saul? When he was searching for the followers of Jesus described in Acts later on, who was he looking for? He knew he was looking for the followers of a man called Jesus. It's speculation. I think Saul had heard of Jesus. He knew he was arresting followers of Jesus later. But the thought never entered his mind that there might be something very important to what this man Jesus had been doing. How could he ignore the discussions? It was open discussion. Is this the Messiah? The Pharisees asked that specific question in John 10. How could he ignore the reports of the preachings of the healings? But ignore them, he did. Now, he ran out of victims as he was trying to clean out all these followers of Jesus, the Nazarene. And so he decided to go up to Damascus, next biggest city. So he gets papers from his religious superiors, and he departs in fine style to Damascus. He's not walking. He's riding rather elegantly on a horse. You know, you had to be pretty important in those days to be riding on a horse. Most people walked. You know the story. He's riding the horse. He's thinking about who he's going to arrest, and he is massively struck by some force. He's violently thrown to the ground. There's no soft landing. This is hard, rocky ground. It's a brutal event. I would say in our day, it's like getting hit by a cement truck. Imagine one moment you're riding peacefully on the horse, next you're on the ground. You're in pain. You're blinded by this intense laser-like light like you've never seen before. Your vision's gone. You're blind. And a voice speaks to you, and it knows your name. Now, this takes this event out of the possibility that this is just a random earthquake or some cave-in on the roadway. No, this is no random event. This has got your name written all over it. When your name is called, you know it's about you. This is personal. You know the story as well as I do. This is one of the greatest conversion stories of all time. Getting knocked off a horse. There are many wonderful conversion stories, but I don't think anything ever beats this. So let's pause again here and say, okay, what are the lessons so far? Well, first of all, we talked about the big movements and the groups losing their spirituality, but now the lessons are personal. The man named Saul is a very devout person. He respected Jehovah. He wanted to do his will. He was totally consecrated. He was dedicated to what he thought was Jehovah's will. He was very intelligent. He was one of the outstanding men of his entire generation. His education in the scriptures was second to none. I'm speculating that he heard of Jesus. How could he have missed the story of the triumphal entry the week before Passover, when the crowds were going wild, shouting Hosanna? How could he be in religious studies and not be hearing discussion of this? How could he have not heard about the crucifixion? It was a religious crucifixion, religious offense. It was no secret, but he was blind and deaf to what was going on. Nicodemus was more alert than he was. Joseph of Arimathea was more alert. So were multiple other Pharisees. Was Saul so convinced that he had the truth that he couldn't see or hear what was going on in front of him? Somehow, I think that's one of the lessons. Saul had an amazing amount of the truth. He knew the scriptures. He believed in the resurrection. He believed in Messiah. And from all we can see, he was not an arrogant person. I see no evidence that he was proud. He comes across as being very sincere. What was going on that he couldn't see what was going on down the street? And maybe a better question is, are there things happening right down our street that we're not seeing? Does something happen in the brain, and the brain gets satisfied and it stops? It's like a hunger level, and once you eat enough, you stop. Do we learn some good things and then we stop learning? The Sadducees, they loved the first 5 books, and then they stopped. The Pharisees, they saw more than the Sadducees, and they added the prophets and the writers and the Psalms, and then they stopped. Saul was in that group. He stopped. Is this some kind of condition called lukewarm, where you lose the hot? Or maybe you lose the cold. Paul stopped. And he missed the fact for a while that God still had something additional to show him. He missed the fact for some reason that the promised Messiah was right down the street. How could anybody be so blind? But you know what's a better question? How could we be so blind? Are we so convinced that we have the truth? And I'm in this category. I am in this category, convinced that we have the truth, great measures of the truth. Is there anything, any possibility that God has something else to teach us? Do we still need to watch and pray? You know, that was one of the last things that Jesus said. He said, watch and pray. He didn't say get to some level of understanding and stop. I think of the story of the virgins who are waiting for the bridegroom, and they have the wise have their lamps. Well, actually everybody had the lamps, but the wise, when their lamps kind of went down, they had more oil. So there's almost something there that says you don't use all the oil at once. I don't know what that all means. But I wonder if we have to get knocked off a horse to wake up the fact that God might have something that he wants us to keep learning. What am I missing? I'm probably missing something every day. Now, I have no agenda. I have no doctrine that I am now going to present and say, hey, you're all missing this. No, I don't have one. Paul was a better man than I would ever be one sliver of. And he missed something really big. So Saul, the Pharisee. We've seen his lineage. We've seen his education. And how does it all end? Well, in some respects, it ends really good. Because this amazing man takes the devotion and goes through so much. And you know, when Jesus speaks to Ananias and says, go talk to this man, Saul, because he is my chosen instrument. Jesus, the next sentence says, I'm going to teach him how much he has to suffer. And in the days and weeks and years that followed this, getting knocked off the horse was just the beginning. He was beaten, he was whipped, he was shipwrecked, put into prison, greatly abused. This incredible man, Saul, has to be among the greatest disciples of Jesus Christ that ever lived. He was chosen to teach the Gentiles, the Jews, the kings, the peasants, to teach the story of Jesus Christ. In Acts 9, Jesus says, this man is my chosen instrument to bear my name before the Gentiles and their kings, as well as to the sons of Israel. Hey, you know what? That means everybody. Gentiles and Jews, that's everybody. Indeed, I myself will show him what he must suffer for the sake of my name. So when we look at him 20 years later, he is no longer Saul the Pharisee. He is Paul, the apostle and servant of Jesus Christ. I wanted to look and see at something Paul wrote at the very end of his life. And I was looking for something that he wrote to a group. As opposed to, we know his last letters were probably to Timothy and to Titus. But I wanted something that he wrote to an ecclesia, because I thought it would apply to us more as a group. And I think that last letter that was to a group was his letter to Philippi. And he's in prison now in Rome. And the letter does mention his history of being a Pharisee. And we don't have time to get into this beautiful love letter, but the first thing he does is tell them how much he loves them, and he repeats that a number of times, and it's basically a thank you for their generosity and efforts to help him. And in the middle of the letter, I'm going to jump to chapter 3, verse 10, Philip's translation. Chapter 3 is where he talks about being a Pharisee and all his experiences. And he says there, "Now I long to know Christ." A great statement. And also in the second chapter, well, here, a couple things before I get to the second chapter. But in Philippians, Paul gives us two great confidence-building statements. One is in chapter 1, verse 6. "I feel sure the one who has begun his good work in you will go on developing it." That's for us. If you ever wonder how you're doing, read this. Paul says, "I feel sure that the one who has begun his good work in you will go on developing it." Here's the great apostle Paul, and he's sure about this. God will finish the good work. That's pretty terrific. And in the second chapter, verse 13, he says, "God is at work within you." Think about that. Ponder that. God is at work within you, giving you the power to achieve his purpose. So how is that for empowering? Giving you the power to achieve his purpose, not your purpose, not my purpose, his purpose. What a relief. My favorite is in chapter 2, verse 5. "Let Christ himself be your example." So don't forget to spend some time with Jesus. Spend some time in the Gospels. Let Christ himself be your example. Nothing else. Nobody else. Read the stories over and over again about the blind man being able to see, the lame walking, the dead coming back to life. Summarize and conclude. We've traced the legacy of these religious organizations that Paul was initially a member, and he was part of the group called the Separatists. That was a pretty good beginning. We know that they were founded on good principles, but as a group, they lost it. And we know that Paul was highly consecrated, and he thought he had the truth, but he didn't have all of the truth. And one of the greatest lessons of this story is the transformation that Paul made. What a turnaround, what a change this man made from being an attacker and destroyer of the church and who he became as the teacher and mentor of the entire movement. This is an example. This change, this transformation is an example for the ages. We can change also. Not just who we were 25 years ago, that we're different than we were 25 years ago, but I'm talking about change who we were last week. So you and I probably have a lot more to learn. We can't take the position that we know everything and we know everything about his plan. And remember what Jesus said pretty much as he was leaving: watch and pray. And I do like the way Paul ends that letter to the Philippians, and I'll read it in closing. "May the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ be with your spirit." Thank you.